Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Welcome to the first episode of Drinks Insider, the podcast that dives into the beverage market. In upcoming episodes, we'll be hearing from entrepreneurs creating innovative new products, as well as market experts who explain how to get into the market, including the do's and don'ts. So just to set some expectations, I will primarily focus on the US market, as that is the most lucrative in the world. As highly competitive as it is, it still offers the most opportunity. But while the US can be one of the most profitable markets to be in, it's not always the most innovative. Often the innovation happens elsewhere and is later adopted in the US, which is why I will also speak to plenty of non-Americans. But to start, I thought it was important to take the temperature of the market. So in this episode, I will be speaking to Kaylee Theriault, in charge of beverage alcohol thought leadership at Nielsen IQ. As you'll hear, there's not much she doesn't know about the US market. So just to be clear, this interview was originally recorded in March 2024. Let's dive in. Kaylee, thank you so much for being here. So to start, can you tell us a little bit about Nielsen IQ?
Yeah, Nielsen IQ is a global research company that looks at all markets, but specifically within the United States, we look at the beverage alcohol industry across the 50 states, and we have coverage of retail sales data for the off-premise, so things like grocery stores, liquor stores, convenience stores, things like that. And then we also measure the on-premise, so bars and restaurants.
Okay, now you're a leader in this space. How did you get involved?
Yeah, so I joined Nielsen IQ about 8 years ago. And since then, I've worked across all different types of clients. And 4 years ago, I landed myself into a beverage alcohol role working on thought leadership. I mean, we always get the question of what is thought leadership? And really, that just means we're looking at industry insights across the beverage alcohol industry. So always looking at data around beer, wine, and spirits, and just trying to better understand what's going on from a broad trend standpoint.
So Nielsen is the leader in this space. Can you just briefly tell me where you get your data from?
Yeah, our retail data for the off-premise, that is, does come from a variety of retail partnerships that we have and that we maintain ongoing. So we receive retailer feeds for all those channels I mentioned previously. And then that data is integrated all together and compiled, cleansed, and then we're able to look at an output of those trends for beer, wine, and spirits.
Great. All right, let's get into it. So I have read that you've said that Nielsen IQ predicts that there's going to be a shift from the on-premise to the off-premise. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think if we jump back a little bit further, and we never like to talk about the pandemic too much, but back in the pandemic days, consumers were at home drinking quite a bit here in the US. And what we saw from that, obviously, was the closure of the on-premise. And so if we fast forward a couple of years from then, we saw this shift out, you know, consumers going back out to bars and restaurants. They missed out on a lot of that social activity. And now we're starting to get to a more level place with on and off-premise sales, combined with some of the economic conditions that are occurring. And so with inflationary pressures and consumers a little bit uneasy about where they're spending their money, we do see consumers have pulled back a little bit in their on-premise purchasing, especially if prices have risen on menus as well. And they're looking to put some of those occasions back into the off-premise with some at-home consumption of beer, wine, and spirits.
So if people are retreating to the home, which categories do you predict are most likely to benefit?
That's an interesting one, because for years we've been talking about ready to drinks and hard seltzers have definitely fallen off. being one of the top trends. And so if we think about at-home consumption now, consumers are really leaning into spirits-based ready-to-drink offerings. So things like canned cocktails, a lot of the offerings that they would normally want to get at a bar or restaurant, I think they're going to be leaning into those, especially this summer when they want that margarita at home. And so it's easy to pop open the can and the convenience of it and pour it over ice and have a cocktail that they would have had in a bar or restaurant, but in the comfort of their own home at a much lower price point.
Is that the driver, the price point and being able to have a complex drink at home? Or have you got any thoughts about what's driving that? Is it the single serving size?
I think it's a variety of things driving those ready to drinks, and part of it being the convenience of being in a can. The price point would probably be a little bit higher compared to if you were to mix up a batch of your own margaritas or buy all of the different ingredients. But if you're like myself, I'm not quite the at-home bartender. And so the ease and the consistency, I think, of having the same cocktail over and over again makes those really enjoyable. And also being able to take them on the go. So if you want to enjoy one of those cocktails away from home, a friend's home or a different venue of that sort, you're able to enjoy those cocktails without having to mix up something fancy at somebody else's place or in a different type of venue.
I think that's true. As you're speaking, I realize my own at-home cocktail making consists of something and tonic water, and that's it. That's as much as I'm capable of doing.
What are the things? Opening a glass of wine or something, or a bottle of wine or something.
Well, I can definitely do that. That is no problem. But cocktails, oh, no. One of the things I was really interested in, something that you said in one of your talks, where you said beverage consumers can be divided into strugglers and thrivers. Can you talk a bit about these categories and how each of them consumes alcohol?
Yeah, so those consumers that you were talking about comes from Nielsen IQ's consumer divide segment. And we actually look at those from a total standpoint, not just beverage alcohol specifically. But what we did was we started a couple of years after we kind of came out of that COVID timeframe, we started getting a gauge from consumers around how they feel about their current financial situation. And so rather than looking at different things that have impacted them, we got a sense of how they feel about the situation. So strugglers are going to be those consumers that feel a little bit uneasy about their financial situation, and they're concerned about the next several months and where their money's coming from and what they're going to be spending it on. Where on the other end of that spectrum, we see thriving consumers that are very confident in their financial situations and aren't really concerned about their financial future despite all of the economic things that are happening. But what we have done is we've taken and overlaid beverage alcohol purchasing on top of that segmentation, because there's a few different consumer groups falling in the middle of there too. And what we see is that those at the stronger end of feeling confident in their financial situations, those thrivers, are really the heavy buyers of beverage alcohol purchasing. So they're the ones leaning into things like premiumization a little bit more, likely going to the on-premise more often than some of those consumers at the other end. But really, I think it's something that's been said in the past is that beverage alcohol is always a little bit recession resilient or resistant. And so I think that comes through a lot of times, is even with that segmentation where consumers are still going to be purchasing beverage alcohol despite their economic condition.
That's so interesting. So those categories, do they overlay with other consumer behavior as well? Like, are there strivers and thrivers in, you know, across multiple purchase categories, or is this specifically beverage alcohol?
Yeah, so those consumer groups are category agnostic and more so about how they feel, but we're able to look at those across each of the different categories, and I haven't done it specifically outside of the beverage alcohol world. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're definitely able to look at that.
Okay. Now, this one I'm really interested in. Can you explain what you mean by the split brain budget, and what does it mean for alcohol?
Yeah, the split brain budget is one of those fun little sayings that you say and people are like, tell me more, I want to know more.
And I do want to know more.
We can't take credit for that one, unfortunately. I wish I could. But that was actually a concept that was written about in the Wall Street Journal a while back. But I think the phrase resonated really well. And when you start to explain it to different people, they're like, oh, yeah, I do that, actually. And so what we mean is that there are consumers that are going to continue to purchase as they would in some categories, and they're going to cut back in other places in their lives. So if we think about it in terms of your total store purchasing, you might be going to the store and buying private label paper towels and not buying that name brand anymore. But when it comes to beverage alcohol, you're still going to buy within your repertoire and likely spend what you would on those premium products. So you're going to cut back in some areas of your life and still splurge in other areas. One funny example is somebody shopping at the dollar store in their Gucci sneakers. And that's kind of that idea of like, you're still going to buy those premium products, but you might cut back in other areas where quality might not be as important to you.
That is so interesting. So where I live in Europe, that is a classic spending behavior where people are complete cheapskates about, you know, things like you're saying about kitchen towels. Do you have any sense about how people allocate that premium spending versus the cheapskate no-name stuff?
I don't have a necessary, like a specific breakdown of how that works. But when we think about it within the beverage alcohol world, we usually think about a consumer's repertoire. And what I mean when I say that is that we have a set of products that we're likely to drink across, and it might include some ultra premium items. It might include some premium items, and there might actually be a couple of value items in there as well. We might like that inexpensive bottle of bubbly or something like that. But, it's tough to say, you know, how much is being spent on that splurge side of things, but there are still a set of consumers that are willing to pay a premium for products. They're willing to pay for a premium experience in the on-premise, and even going out to a bar or restaurant and having a cocktail is an idea of premiumization, and it might be a splurge to some. But with the idea of drinking within your repertoire, we do see consumers maybe not opting for their ultra premium option all the time, but they might be switching to a premium or super premium.
Yeah, I take back the words cheapskate. Just thinking about all the things that are in my cupboards, I'm not, of course, not a cheapskate. I'm thrifty, and I assume everyone else is. So when you're talking about the word splurge, do you think people think of themselves as splurging, or do you think they think of it as this is my standard and this is the limit below which I will not go in this category?
I sometimes think that some consumers do think about it as like, oh, I'm splurging. This is going to cost me a little bit more from a monetary perspective. I think consumers definitely recognize the price increases that we're seeing at the shelf across all categories. But when it comes to beverage alcohol, I think consumers still view it as a treat for themselves, and they're willing to treat themselves a little bit more than they might in other categories. And alcohol is a big piece of that. And then the other thing that we see with premiumization is that some consumers like to have a perception of being able to purchase the best. And so sometimes it's about putting their best foot forward. If they do have some other friends over and they want to show that they've got a nicer bottle of tequila, they might pull that super premium bottle out of the cabinet. But if they're mixing a drink for themselves during the middle of the week, they might just consume a premium product. And so I think consumers do view some of these products as a treat for themselves.
Do you think that people exhibit those same behaviors across categories? Like if somebody's pulling out the really good bottle of tequila, are they likely to do that with wine and with beer as well? Or do they have different ways of approaching different categories?
I do think that within the wine space, that's probably a very similar stance that consumers are taking. We always talk about a $20 threshold at like shelf price with wine. And a lot of consumers see that as, you know, a $20 bottle of wine is a nice bottle that they can bring out in their own home. But if they're gifting, they sometimes go a little bit above that price point because they see the shelf price as an indicator. But wine can sometimes be really confusing to somebody that's not super ingrained in the different varietals and stuff like that. And then with beer, I think it's more brand-based or style-based. So somebody might want to enjoy imported beer, or they might be considering some of those domestic premium beers. And so then from there, it becomes more about a brand than it would probably a price point.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about money. You've said that investors are now looking for volume growth, and suppliers are probably going to be pushing for volume also. So which segments of beverage alcohol are most likely to benefit from this, and which ones are likely to suffer?
Yeah, what we saw at the end of 2023 is that there's sort of a differing trend that's happening with dollars and volume. Dollars are up, but cases are down across across all of the categories in differing ways. When we started to dig a little bit deeper, we saw that ready-to-drink items are really impacting all three of the categories. And our definition at Nielsen IQ for ready-to-drinks is going to include things like hard seltzers, flavored malt beverages, and hard kombuchas, hard teas. We have wine RTDs in there, and then those spirits-based canned cocktails. And what we see is that those are really impacting each one of the categories from a volume perspective, but still holding up dollars because consumers are spending about the same. And so as we move into this year, a lot of our supplier partners are asking us, you know, when is my volume going to come back? Because on their top spirits categories, top beer categories, they're not really achieving those same volume numbers that they were a couple of years ago. And the other piece of that too is that prices have gone up across a number of those categories. They've taken their prices up, and so that's going to negatively impact their volume if they cross some certain thresholds. So I do think that ready-to-drinks are going to continue to benefit this year, and some of those categories that are performing well. Imports have been doing really well in the beer space. We've seen sort of a shift to white wines within the wine category. And then with spirits, we see whiskeys doing pretty well. And then tequilas have just been on a kick for quite some time. So I think those categories are going to continue that trend, while the other categories have to find ways to catch up and maintain their volume levels.
That's interesting. So I don't want to put you on the spot, and I don't expect you to pull numbers out of your head, but you've just said, you know, wine mixers. A lot of the audience are wine people, and I know that they're panicking about their sales. So are wine mixers a bright spot? And can you tell me anything about where they sit in the market? Is it tiny? Is it growing? Is it what do you think?
When you say wine mixers, are you referring to wine ready to drinks?
Yeah. Sorry, wine ready to drinks.
Okay. No, you're good. I just wanted to confirm that. Wine ready to drinks we can look at in two ways. Some ways we see suppliers in the U.S. have focused on doing wine-based cocktails and some wine spritzers. And so they mimic more of those other RTD type products that exist in the spirits and beer world. But the other thing that we do include in some of our wine RTDs are canned wines. So wine and alternative packaging, because it really does fall into being a more convenient way to consume wine. You might not be able to take your glass bottle to the beach or to the pool, but you can easily take that can and crack it open and enjoy the wine where you wouldn't normally would. But those are on the relatively small side of things, but maintaining year over year.
Yeah, I think that category, the can category, has been held back by quality issues of, you know, just the process of canning. It means it's not always consistent. I think sometimes that's getting sorted out now, so maybe there'll be some growth in that sector. Okay, so given the push for volume, does this mean that we're going to see more private label on the market?
Yeah, private label is a little bit tricky in the U.S. I think there's a couple of big retailers like Costco that have their branded private label. And then the other way that private label comes through is in control brands. And those are a little bit funky on the control of the distribution. So private label in the U.S. is relatively small and like less than 1% of sales. I wouldn't say there's too many consumers that lean into those. But earlier I mentioned how consumers have a repertoire that they consume across. And so they might, instead of opting for that super premium option, they might just grab their premium option, still, you know, looking for a nice drinking experience, but they might be doing a little bit of mix up there rather than switching to something like a private label, like they would do in other CPG categories.
That's really interesting. Okay, so again, talking about Europe, you know, up to 50% of the wine sold here can be private label, and they are hugely profitable. Why haven't they got much of a foothold in the US?
It's a good question. I don't look at private label too often.
No,
I haven't dove into that. But even thinking about it from a consumer standpoint, it wouldn't be like you go into a retailer and you see their private label necessarily. They're all branded private labels. And so in some cases, I don't think consumers might be realizing that they're purchasing even a private label option. So that might be happening and keeping it on the relatively small side too.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Going back to cans and RTDs, actually, I've got a question for you. Are canned cocktails part of the spirits category, or are they a category by themselves?
I love that you asked that question. We're currently working on an analysis where we sort of scope it out a little bit different. And in the past, we've always put canned cocktails and any type of ready to drink with their respective alcohol base. So it's those spirits RTDs cocktails have always fallen within the broader spirits category. But what we're seeing is that trends are so different and impacting volumes that we're starting to carve these out as a fourth category because we understand the impacts that they're having on shelf sets, consumer decisions, dollars, volume, all of those sorts of things. And so we're starting to pull them out into their own space. So what we actually see is that a number of spirits, RTDs, canned cocktail drinkers are drinking wine and beer, and they're not just sticking within that traditional spirits lane, which sort of makes them their own category because they're being consumed by such a broad set of drinkers.
Do you think the fact that they sort of exist at the moment in a hybrid space, does that make it difficult for people to get distribution of these products?
Yeah, so on the distribution front, because of the spirits base that a lot of the canned cocktails do have, it limits where they can be distributed. So something like a hard seltzer or a flavored malt beverage can be sold in a variety of convenience stores across the U.S. as if they're a beer. With canned cocktails and those spirits ready to drinks, they're limited on where they can sell. And so in some states, they're not allowed to be sold in the convenience store. And you actually have to seek out a liquor store to find these items. And so it really limits if a consumer is just stopping into the convenience store to grab what they want for the party that they're on their way to. It really limits the ability for many of those canned cocktails to be sold, because you have to seek out that destination of a liquor store for purchase. And what we hear is a lot of legislation is being talked about around different states. And a state like California had been pushing for a number of months, and I think it's still up in the air on where they stand on getting these items into distribution in convenience stores, because they do have the same amount of alcohol in them, ABV-wise, to some of those hard seltzers. So it just limits their potential a little bit when they're not able to be sold everywhere that other canned cocktails and ready-to-drink items can be sold.
That's really interesting. So I'm guessing, but I would imagine that if the distribution is fragmented, then the brand landscape is also fragmented. And if you solved the distribution problem, then we'd see the emergence of like really big brands. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Fragmentation is the perfect word for ready-to-drinks and what it's kind of doing to the industry. And it has been a little bit tougher, I think, for some brands to break through within the spirits ready-to-drink space because of that limitation around distribution.
I suppose thinking about it the other way, though, there must be an opportunity for small people or craft people to be able to develop a brand locally because they're not competing with a big national brand. That's speculation.
Yeah. We've seen some success from smaller brands, but a lot of them are doing a really good job of differentiating themselves in some way. So we see a lot of flavor turnover, and if they're a copy paste of a bigger brand, they're not going to be as successful. But we've seen some small brands and some new brands come into this space that have made an impact because of how different they are from what's already out there. And consumers love the differentiation in those products.
Okay, so let's talk broadly now. Which drinks categories are in growth and which ones are in decline? And I mean across all drinks categories, not just beverage alcohol, if it's possible to speak to that.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the data too specific, but one area that we've seen a lot of growth in is within the functional beverage space. And when we kind of define functional beverages, it's a little bit loose, I guess, in terms of what would be included there. But think about things that have, you know, electrolytes, nootropics, different types of attributes that would really lend to health and wellness, things that would benefit a consumer. And we actually see a number of buyers leaning into those products. And we had a webinar recently on those that I'd recommend everybody check out. But functional beverages are one space that's small and growing and carving out its own category within the beverages space as well. And then they sit really adjacent, I think, to the alcohol brands and stuff, in that there's only so many beverages a consumer can drink within the day. And if they're not wanting to choose something that does contain alcohol, they might lean into some of those functional beverages. And then in between those two spaces, we do have a variety of non-alcohol beer, wine, and spirits products that have popped up over the last handful of years.
Oh, that's interesting. So so you mentioned your webinar. I know that I'll forget this by the end of the interview. If people want to watch that webinar, where do they go?
Yeah, I can share a link with you for sure, but it will be out on it's likely out on our website on nielseniq.com, but I'll definitely share the link with you.
Great. Okay, back to the questions. You mentioned that the product life cycle is shortening. Can you talk about that and why that's happening?
Yeah, so product life cycle shortening is really happening and really driven by those ready-to-drink options. And what we saw with hard seltzers about 5 years ago is that there were a number of initial flavors out there, and you would see, you know, lime and black cherry were popular. And then consumers wanted more. They wanted more flavors, more options. And so not long after that, we saw, you know, the following summer or something like that, we saw new flavor additions. And those started to cycle in and out. And then ever since then, over the past couple of years, we see new flavors coming in every few months, actually. And it's just become so rampant in the innovation space that retailers are having to make decisions almost daily on what items they're going to include in their set and which items they're going to turn away because of all the innovation that continues to be launched in this space by a variety of brands. And so RTDs have really driven that shortening of the product life cycle, and needing the next big thing to fill its spaces is coming a lot sooner than what it used to.
That's so interesting. So it's a good time to be a flavor scientist, I guess. But is that speed because something hasn't sort of completely grabbed the market and so it's not engendering customer loyalty? Or is it because customers have changed and even if they like something, they're prepared to abandon it to try something else?
I think customers and buyers are starting to get in this mindset of like, oh, I want to try something new and different, which is just accelerating that trend even more with the different flavors that are coming out. And I think it's a little bit of a push and pull. Some flavors have launched and they flopped, but there are a number of fruity flavors and even some savory flavors that consumers have taken a liking to, but only for a short period of time. And they're ready for that thing of what's next. And I think that kind of relates back to all of us in our day-to-day lives of there's just so many options in front of us when we're on our phones all day long, and we're always, our attention's always right there. And something new is always popping up for us to look at on our feeds and whatnot. And so I think consumers have just gotten into that auto mode of always expecting something new and different. And that's kind of translating into some of these flavor innovations that are popping up.
That is really interesting. And is this happening across all demographics, or is it mostly among younger people, or is this something you're seeing across the market?
I think RTDs specifically have such a broad range of consumers that it's really being pulled by anybody that consumes a ready-to-drink, which can range from a legal drinking age Gen Z up into Gen X and the younger boomers. So they're being pulled through, I would say, across all generations, but we do see different things happening across each and within each generation as well when it comes to consumption.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of research. I was in Australia late last year and listening to research there where they were saying something much the same thing, that the whole idea of boundaries is collapsing, that people no longer think of themselves as being a wine drinker or a spirits drinker or a beer drinker, that the people are now drinking across categories. Would you agree with that people are now sort of have ceased to think of themselves as being their identity being I'm a spirits drinker or I'm a beer drinker?
I would definitely agree with that. And we have data that shows how the overlap of beer, wine, and spirits has just grown so much. And that's being driven by a lot of those ready-to-drink options. And yeah, consumers are no longer staying in their single lane. They're consuming across all of the different categories. And I think the different flavor options that are out there are pulling consumers in. So outside of just traditional flavor, but thinking about something like whiskeys and scotches where they're being aged in wine barrels is sort of pulling over some of those consumers to try different things because they like the flavors that come through in their wines. And so they might be looking to try that within spirits as well. And then within beer, we do see a number of different styles popping up in the craft world that are capturing different consumers than I think what they have in the past and really expanding the offerings that they have.
I want to go back to talking about functional drinks because I think this is really interesting. So I guess this is part of the better for you movement. Do you think that this new sort of post-COVID interest in health and wellness is going to lead to a proliferation of new categories altogether? Like, I've heard people talk about fibre drinks, and I cannot for the life of me imagine drinking a drink for fibre, but maybe I'm the wrong audience. Are there sort of these new categories emerging that we haven't seen and are likely to become big?
Yeah, I think fiber drinks is probably one example. And another category that's popped up are mushroom-based things. And I myself am not a huge fan of different types of mushrooms. And I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
Well, let me ask you this. So I'm outside the market where you can have mushroom drinks.
I'm talking about non-psychedelic mushrooms.
Oh, right. Okay. I was getting really excited there.
I lost my train of thought because I'm like, she's going to think I'm talking about like psychedelic mushrooms. But no,
I got really excited.
The functional beverages of like just regular mushrooms have grown in popularity. And we're seeing mushrooms as an ingredient and non-psychedelic mushrooms really popping up on a lot of labels across all different types of categories. So whether it be beverages or some snacking categories, that's coming into play. But those better for you attributes is something that we track really closely at Nielsen IQ. And we have a ton of data to show how better for you as a segment is really carving out its own space across all categories.
Okay, so I know they're not psychedelic mushrooms. I've got that. But what benefits do the mushrooms offer?
I think they do relate to different benefits when it comes to memory and just some of those core health and wellness benefits that some consumers are looking for, especially after they spent a lot of time. We all spent a lot of time at home during the pandemic and didn't have the greatest of habits when it came to consuming of beverages and snacks. And so they do offer a variety of benefits, I believe, but I'm not too keen on the specifics of those.
Understood. So fiber drinks, mushroom drinks, is there anything else that's appearing on the shelf in the better for you category?
Yeah, I sort of hinted at non-alcohol beer, wine, and spirits. And in the United States, they're relatively new, actually, with the exception of non-alcohol beer. I think we can track non-alcohol beer back to our grandparents and even predating them likely and being on the golf course and things like that. But what we've seen is that a lot of the major suppliers in the US and the major brands have launched their version of a non-alcohol beer. And so it's interesting to see, you know, a regular branded beer and their non-alcohol version right next to it. And they look almost identical to where consumers, I've heard consumers get mix them up sometimes and they don't realize they're buying a non-alcohol version. Within non-alcohol wine, we do see a number of new brands popping up, and it's a little bit varied on how consumers feel about some of those wines. The taste profiles haven't all hit home on them, and so I know some consumers that have tried some non-alc wines, they haven't had a good experience with them, and they're a little bit turned off by them. But there are a number of brands out there that are good, and so I would recommend everybody to just try one.
So you're being very tactful, but some of the non-alc wines are truly terrible. I've done many. I mean, some of them are great, but the difference, I guess, with the beer is that you can ferment the beer to dryness, so it still tastes like beer. It's whereas it's impossible to do that with wine. One of the things about the non-alc wine which really intrigues me is that the process to make wine is unbelievably technological. You know, you put it through a spinning cone and it produces so much greenhouse gases. Do you think there's a first of all, I don't think most consumers realize that, but do you think that the sustainability aspect of drinks matters to people? Do you think if people were to discover that something was a highly technological product or maybe not a very sustainable product, would that make a difference, or is sustainability really important to consumers?
I think it varies by category a little bit, and consumers put a lot of weight into trusting the brands. And if a brand isn't being transparent, they're probably not going to pick up on it. If a brand is being transparent, though, some consumers see the value and maybe paying a little bit more to get something that's organic or sustainably produced. But the labeling trends within the U.S. are pretty blurry. They're not really transparent at all. It's the basic callouts that are included on bottle, and not all consumers have time to do their research. And
yeah,
so
sure.
I think it takes a lot of education. And we have a survey from later last year, a broader study that we put out called The Green Divide, where we do segment consumers a little bit more and look at what they view when it comes to sustainability. obviously in a survey, a lot of consumers are going to say, yeah, sustainability matters to me. 92% of people say that, yes, sustainability is important. But does that always translate to purchasing? No, not necessarily, because we still see billions of dollars being spent on probably a lot of non-sustainable products, especially in that wine space.
Do you think people like sustainable products also because they perceive them as being better quality products and better to consume?
I definitely think that comes through. A lot of it is that perception, like you're alluding to, where if it's produced in a sustainable way, it should taste better because you're paying a little bit higher of a price. You would expect that. But I bet there's some situations in which consumers have realized that the sustainable products don't taste as good, and that's likely why they go back to consuming their other products that might not be as sustainable.
No, it's interesting. Okay, so wine. Let's just talk about wine, which is the category that I know the most about. Wine internationally is in decline, and many, many people are panicking about it. We're seeing vine pools happening in California and in France and in Australia. In your view, is this decline because of temporary issues like inflation and overstocking, or is this a structural change?
It's a combination of a few factors, inflation being a part of that, and some of the economic conditions that a lot of consumers are being faced with, combined with this broader idea of moderation, where consumers are cutting back on their drinking a little bit, and they're trying to consume better products, but not necessarily more. And I know that wine is typically perceived as a product that's a little bit better for you, but consumers are learning that not all wines might be better for you. So I do think that it's a variety of things that are happening around consumer spending, the moderation aspect of it, and then another piece being like alternatives, which comes through in that moderation. So non-alcohol products are coming into play. And then there was one more I was thinking of, and I've sort of forgotten it.
You're going to remember it at 3 o'clock this morning. You're going to wake up and go, that's what it was.
I will.
Does that mean, do you think that there's an opportunity? We've talked about cans already. With the moderation and wine, do you think there's an opportunity for wine in smaller packaging, which is something that the wine trade has struggled with historically?
Yeah. If the flavors come through in the right way and the taste profile of the wines can come through in the right way for alternative packaging, I think that they could be beneficial. And I'll say myself, when I was a naive consumer before joining the beverage alcohol industry, I would see a can of wine and I'd be like, wow, that's really expensive for a can compared to a can of beer or a spirits RTD. And what a lot of consumers, I don't think, don't know, and wine companies have been really, really good about putting the equivalency on those cans, and just some consumers not realizing the equivalency there. But I do think that there's a really big opportunity for wine-based products, especially with the rise in consumers enjoying cocktails and things like that. And so I think wine finding their place within that RTD space and the alternative packaging would make a lot of sense. And with the economic conditions, we do see some consumers leaning into the boxed wine space a little bit more, which have proven to come a long way in terms of their quality and still being at a low price point per how much you're getting, you know.
So you opened a door and I'm going to run through it. So you talked about being a naive consumer. Now that you are immersed in the beverage alcohol market and you're you know, dealing with it every day, has that changed the way that you choose products?
Oh, 100%. It makes it really tough. I guess I do get caught up in the cycle of how new products keep launching. I'm like, oh, I want to try that. And I think maybe a lot of us in the beverage alcohol industry have to like put the brakes on and be like, whoa, I can't try everything. So I do trust a lot of my friends to try products and family and people beyond that at events to try different products. But it does put a different experience in my mind, especially when I'm shopping. And if I go into a retailer and I'm looking at the shelf set for a given set of products, whether it be beer, wine, or spirits, or even RTDs, if I'm confused at that shelf, I'm really worried for what a non-expert or just that general consumer feels like when they walk up to that shelf. It can be overwhelming, and a lot of the products aren't super approachable. So I think that's something that the industry needs to do a little bit better of a job of, is making products approachable and a little bit easier to understand without having to take hours to do research.
That is so interesting. So if you think about something that is a confusing product, without naming a product, but what would be a classic cause of confusion on the shelf for you, do you think?
I think the wine varietals for many consumers are overwhelming. And it helps having the little chart on the back that says, oh, it's sweet versus dry, but that still doesn't really tell you what the taste might be like necessarily. And so for a lot of consumers, the variety that exists within wine is so expansive, and it's amazing to see how all these brands have come into play and found success, but it can be a little bit overwhelming there. And there might be a slightly higher cost of trial than there would be in other categories. And so what I mean when I say that is you might have to buy an entire 750 milliliter bottle of wine versus being able to buy a single of a beer or being able to try that smaller size beer in a restaurant at a much lower price point. So that makes it a little bit easier to see what you like and try your samples.
Yeah. Okay, so let's finally talk about CBD. I've read so many conflicting things about whether CBD is cannibalizing alcohol or whether it's addition or whether it's something that isn't something to be worried about if you're an alcohol. What's your view of where CBD drinks sit in all of this?
Yeah, so we have two different categories that we can talk about with CBD beverages, which follow the legal side of things within the U.S., and those products don't have those intoxicating effects like the THC products would. What we're seeing with CBD products is they're still relatively small, but consumers, as we talked about with functional beverages, they sort of fall into that same place. They're calming, they're relaxing, they do have an adjacency to beverage alcohol and how people perceive some alcohol products in their occasions, but we don't see a huge amount of cannibalization from those quite yet. And then when it comes to THC products, which are starting to become legal across many states in the U.S., still not federally legal, we do see THC beverages popping up, and we see a couple of new strains of cannabis, I guess you could call them, with Delta 8 and Delta 9 beverages, which I am not fully educated on or well-versed in quite yet. But there's a loophole that allows some of these beverages to be sold in liquor stores. And I think with the legalization of cannabis in some areas and these products being sold, I think the impact that we're going to see over the next handful of months and the next couple of years probably as they expand is going to be noticed. And we know in states where they have made cannabis legal, there is a temporary impact to beverage alcohol, but then the levels sort of normalize after a period of time. But it is kind of a toss-up of, you know, consumers are swapping out products within occasions, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out depending on which direction like the legal thing takes us.
So there's a lot going on in the market. To sum it all up, what do you see ahead for the next 12 months?
Yeah, the year ahead is going to be hopefully predictable, but as we know with the beverage alcohol industry, nothing is ever set in stone. We never know what direction social media can take us. We never know what direction pricing can take us and what levers suppliers are pulling on the other end. But I do think that this year it's going to be a battle for share. As, you know, dollars kind of level out, volumes are declining, like we talked about, I think a lot of suppliers are going to be analyzing what's happening to their share and why is, you know, one brand winning over their brand, even though they're very similar. But within the different categories, I think we're going to continue to see imports just performing so well within the beer space, specifically those Mexican imports that have been doing well for the past few years. And then with wine, and you probably know about the historical trend a little bit more in the wine space than I do, but we always see sort of a flip-flop back and forth of, is it red or is it white wine that's popular? And over the past handful of years, reds have really jumped to the top of the list. But over the past year, we've sort of seen a shift back into the white wine space. So Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Grigio doing a little bit better, where the bubbly side of things has sort of always maintained its space, but very much active within celebratory occasions. And then within spirits, we see tequila just still performing so well. And I don't know if that's because every celebrity has launched a tequila of their own, or if consumers are really leaning into those tequilas a little bit more and enjoying the consumption there. But there's a lot of different options. And then anything with a flavor to it, I think consumers are going to take a liking to over the next year.
And one final question. There's a lot of talk about the sober curious movement and people giving up alcohol. What are you seeing and what do you think its impact is on the market?
I definitely think the sober curious movement is having an impact on the industry for sure. And it's evident in a number of different ways. I think people think about Dry January as a point in time, but I like to talk about Dry January as a jumping off point for the year. And what we're going to see over the next several months is that the holiday, key holidays across beverage alcohol, like 4th of July and those year-end holidays at the end of 2024 are going to be even more popular for consumption of non-alcohol beer, wine, and spirits products. And I think a lot of us are just realizing what we're putting into our bodies and we're looking to cut back a little bit, or it might come down to some of the financial impacts, but there will be trade-offs in some occasions, but overall, it's beneficial to the industry to keep a consumer drinking within those alcohol brands, within some of those alcohol taste profiles, even though they might not be containing the alcohol.
That was a fantastic dive into what's going on, and I want to really thank you for giving me so much of your time and your many insights.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.